Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
At this point, the newspaper industry has gotten rolled up and consolidated into a handful of operators that are themselves owned by private equity firms who are now ringing them for cash.
That fact is playing out during COVID in the sense that if you remember after 9/11, it happened in one town. Well, two towns, D.C., but primarily one town. The New York Times, the hometown newspaper, did these amazing portraits of people who had died, the more than 2,000 people that had died. You really connected with them as people who had lost their life because of this national tragedy. Well, we've now had, the equivalent of 73 9/11s or something like that. And local newspapers are not doing those kinds of stories because they don't have the kind of bandwidth that they should have. And profiling people in their community that have died because of COVID, unless you personally know somebody that died, there's not the kind of connection to this tragedy that we all had with 9/11 because of what the New York Times was doing with these portraits.
Happy Thanksgiving. Hope that you're celebrating in warmth and love with family and friends. Maybe just family, given this Thanksgiving. We've got a special Thanksgiving episode of Yang Speaks. I interview Pete Souza. And who the heck is Pete Souza? You're thinking, I've heard that name. He was the White House photographer for all 8 years of the Obama administration. I actually got to benefit from his work. He took a number of pictures of me, which at the time I was like, ooh, like this photographer, good. And now we're interviewing him. It's very heartwarming. He's also the subject of a documentary that's out now, How I See It, that's about his work and his contrasting the Obama administration with the Trump administration in visual form. It's a great documentary. He's one of a kind. He's like the photographer of history. Hope you enjoy it. Happy Thanksgiving, Pete Souza. It is my pleasure to welcome to Yang Speaks, maybe the best known photographer walking the planet today. He was the White House photographer under President Obama and has done a lot of things both before and even since. Pete Souza, welcome, Pete.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Andrew. I appreciate it.
I appreciate the heck out of your being here. It's so fun. I don't know if you know this, but you took my picture in the White House a couple of times. I don't suppose you remember.
Well, I photographed a lot of people coming and going.
So I'm going to regale everyone with this story because I think a lot of people dream about visiting the White House and whatnot. I got invited there as a champion of change in 2012. I was 37 years old at the time. Pete was there taking pictures of the gathering. There was a group of us with President Obama. And then one of the most delightful things about the entire experience was that then you go with Pete down the hall to this photo alcove, I would describe it. And then Pete takes your picture. You get like a mini individual White House photo, courtesy of one of the greatest photographers of all time. And then they send it to you afterwards, and it becomes your profile photo. It's like the greatest experience in the world. I don't know if you realize how
impactful those mini photos that you did of guests were. I guess you've talked to people like me all the time, so everyone tells you the same story.
Certainly was aware how important those were for people, especially if it was their only time meeting President Obama. You know, it's a keepsake for them. So, and I think my office did a good job working with all the different points of contact at the White House to make sure that we did get those pictures out to people so that they would have their keepsake photo that they could then make their profile photo.
It really was. It was like the ultimate school yearbook photo, like revved up to 1,000. So I'm sure a lot of people would want to know, how the heck do you get a job as a White House photographer? It seems like there are so many photographers throughout the country. Photojournalism, it's something that makes me really sad. I'd love to talk to you about this too, where I feel like as a field, it's shrinking in large part because so many of these newspapers are folding, and that the newspapers would be the primary employer, the magazines too, the print magazines. So before we get into kind of the future of photojournalism, how did you develop and then wind up with maybe the highest profile photojournalist gig in the world?
Well, I mean, let me preface this by saying that given where we are today, which is, not long after Joe Biden has been elected, I've got a lot of people reaching out to me saying, I want to be Joe Biden's photographer. And, and my response to them is, I try to be blunt. I go, if Joe Biden doesn't know you now, he's not going to hire you. He's had a campaign photographer for the last 2 years. That's the guy that's likely to get the job. For me, I just by sheer coincidence, these things happen in life. I was working for the Chicago Tribune. I was based in D.C. in Washington. So when Barack Obama was elected to the Senate in 2004, Jeff Zeleny, who was then a reporter with the Washington Bureau of the Tribune, he and I documented Obama's first year in the Senate. And I got access that nobody else got because I was with the quote unquote hometown newspaper. So I got to know him on a professional, just in a professional way. But he also got a chance to see how I worked, I like to say I worked with, a small footprint. I try not to interfere with what's going on. And he saw that I took my job seriously. So, skip ahead to 4 years, he gets elected president and asked me to be his White House photographer. So that's the way it happened for me.
I'd imagine there were campaign photographs being taken all the time. That was not you, or that was you?
2007 is when he started the campaign, because he started actually in February 2007, pretty early. And I covered probably the first 3 months of the campaign. And then I quit. I quit the Tribune because I thought they had just been bought by a real estate magnate, and I didn't like the direction the newspaper was going. I was, didn't think that I could stomach it anymore. And even though I sort of had the inside track to covering his campaign, I just could not see myself working for the Tribune anymore. And I ended up taking a teaching job, a photojournalism teaching job at Ohio University. And then I would occasionally, as a freelancer, hook up with him on the campaign trail. So I sort of kept my foot in the door a little bit.
And then he wins in 2008. And then you get the word, hey, come back to D.C. and become the White House photographer. That must have been quite a call. Was it from Barack himself, or was it from someone on his team?
Gibbs was kind of my main contact with Obama, and Robert Gibbs, a lot of people, just think of him as the press secretary, but Gibbs was one of the most influential aides. He was really like sort of a senior advisor, as well as the press secretary. So he was the one who called me on behalf of the president-elect. He called me the night before classes for the winter quarter were supposed to begin. And on a Sunday night. And so the following morning, Monday, I walked into my boss at Ohio University and told him that I was leaving that afternoon for DC and I was quitting my job. I kind of had given them a heads up that this might happen, but you know, you never know until you get that call.
So then you proceeded to spend 8 years as the White House photographer. So I mean, obviously you'd spent a lot of time in DC, so you got very familiar with the environment. But coming into the White House, that must have been an incredible journey where you must have felt like you were documenting history essentially every day for 8 years. What was that adjustment like? And the other question I'd have is, it seems completely physically impossible to me for any one human to cover everything that happened in the White House. So is there like a whole team of you?
Yeah, I had a staff. My approach going in was that I was going to be all in every day, because my attitude was, if you were going to document for history, you can't predict when history is going to happen. You know, you don't always get
notice.
2 hours notice. Yeah. But then also in terms of photography, you know, I just felt that the fleeting moments, little moments, the way he interacts with certain people, if you're not there all the time, you're definitely not going to make that picture. And so I wanted to make sure that I was all there all the time to make those fleeting moments, because I didn't ever want to miss anything. So that's sort of the way I approached the job. And I you know, I knew what I was in for. I don't think my wife knew what I was in for, because, you know, you kind of put your personal life on hold for, and, you know, in my case, for 8 years. But, you know, I did have a staff. So it's, don't feel sorry for me, because I could have easily, you know, taken a day off here and there. But you know, my attitude was just always be there.
So when does the day start and end for you in that situation? Like, I feel like you'd want to live near the White House just to be able to get there.
Yeah, I didn't live that far. I lived about 15, 20 minutes away. And I would try to get there. You know, one of the, you know, things that we have to worry about as staffers that he doesn't really have to worry about is, you know, you got to commute. You got to get there. Whereas his commute was, you know, 2 minutes. Walk from the residence to the Oval Office. So, but I would try to get there at least an hour before him. He would come down to the Oval Office sometime between 9 and 10 in the morning. So I try to get there, you know, about an hour before. I did have responsibilities as the head of my office, and I would try to deal with those either early in the morning or at the end of the day. And then I would basically tag along with him all day long until he went home for dinner. And, you know, and sometimes after dinner, he would come back to the West Wing, or there'd be events, you know, on the state floor or outside of DC that he would go to at night. And so, you know, every day was, you know, a little different, but pretty much I would just tag along with him, you know, at least 10 hours a day, sometimes 15, sometimes longer.
So you're documenting him. People like me come in, and people like me, you don't really remember, because I met President Obama, let's say either 3 or 4 times, something like that, either in a group or in a collective setting. And you were joking that, like, by the 6th picture, you might recognize someone again. I did get a picture every time I met him, which was kind of nice. It's like, it was just, you're around him. There were always these photographers trying to capture the moment. So, and you don't even realize it when you're the guest at that moment. And so then you just get the photo later and you're like, incredible. You know, all of my exchanges, immortalized. Now you probably have all sorts of, crazy experiences and recollections. Was there anything that you're able to share about an experience where you were like, wow, that just happened?
For me, a lot of the wow moments were not necessarily like the big event, but more, those moments that I talked about, those little moments which really, define him as a human being. You know, I mean, I mean, Ben Rhodes, who, you know, was a deputy national security advisor, and his daughter, he came in with his daughter like around Halloween time 1 year, and she was just learning to crawl. And so Obama gets down on the rug of the Oval Office, squats down, and gets Ella to crawl to him. And then he lies down on his back and he's lifting her up. And, you know, those moments are just like, I can't believe this is happening as I'm photographing this. You know, certainly the bin Laden raid and big historic events like that obviously are also wow in a kind of different way, where you sort of really feel the weight of history taking place right in front of you. But, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that was advantageous about being a seasoned photographer, photojournalist, is I was sort of able to keep my emotions in check, you know, and not get so high, if you will, when these big moments are happening. So, you know, just sort of try to keep my level pretty even, so I'm not so overwhelmed by what's happening that I'm still able to make, you know, pictures.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech, who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang. This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
You've had any number of books, of photo books, 7 published books over the last number of years, and one of them, Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents, got a ton of attention more recently because of a documentary about your work. It came out originally in 2018, and now it's having a resurgence. It must be incredibly fun and exciting for you to be publishing these catalogs of your work that are touching so many people, even years after the fact.
The Shade book, you know, would never have come into existence if Donald Trump hadn't been elected president. It really chronicles his first couple of years, the craziness of how he conducted himself in office. And then by comparison, I would show photographs and have my captions of similar situations with President Obama. And I think that contrast, you know, it really made people stop and think about how crazy this administration is, you know, how crazy he is in terms of the way he behaves in office.
Yeah, the juxtaposition between Trump's tweets and then some photo of Barack being a human being, it was very artfully done. And it's one of the things that makes it really pressing to figure out why over 70 million Americans voted for Donald Trump.
What's your thinking of why? I mean, you know, this guy, you know, the one thing that he does good is market himself, even though most of the marketing is based on, you know, lies and untruths.
Yeah, there are a couple of ingredients for me, Pete. Number one is just simple polarization, where at this point, there are a lot of people who are just like on the Republican team or on the Democrat team, and they'll vote for whomever on the basis of maybe a few key policies. I think a really huge part of it is that many Americans mistrust what they see as career politicians. They think they're phonies. They don't think they're actually there for the right reasons. And that Donald Trump, for all of his bad qualities, strikes them as somehow more quote unquote genuine in a particular way because his behavior is more unconstrained.
In a different kind of way, do you think that's why you struck a chord with so many young people?
You
didn't come at it as a politician, and yet you got a lot of attention during the primaries for good reason. I mean,
well, thank you, Pete, for noticing. There's a desire among some Americans for a different approach to politics. I think that antipathy towards politicians is frankly stronger among Republicans than Democrats. I think that there were some Democrats who were very happy to see an entrepreneur and non-politician like myself run. But I think that thirst is higher in the Republican Party. Let's put it that way. So we talked about how your book Shade has been boosted tremendously by the documentary that came out about you, The Way I See It. How did that documentary come about?
So they approached me about 2 years ago. It was Laura Dern's production partner, Jamie Lemons. At that time, I was promoting the Shade book, actually. And I do these presentations with big screen showing the photographs, sort of doing the same thing I kind of do on Instagram and what I eventually did in the book in front of a live audience. And she and Evan Hayes, another producer who had done the film Free Solo, came to one of my presentations. And I think they were like, OK, this is we got to do something with this. And so it took them probably, I don't know, 2 months to convince me because I like, you know, my privacy and
very ironic, Pete. There you were, a fly on the wall for all these other people. Yeah. And then they wanted and, to do the subject.
You know, obviously I had a following on Instagram, but there's still a fair amount of anonymity when you're not like.
It's true. You're not the subject. It's just
you're not the subject. But like, so, yeah. You know, I had to think about it. I'd convince my wife that it was okay. And
it seems like you owe your wife a great deal, Pete.
I do, for sure.
That's fine.
And I just thought that it was worth giving up that some more anonymity to try to reach people with this film. Because I think, you know, not everybody's on social media. And I thought, you know, a documentary film could do a really effective job of getting, you know, my message out, what I've been doing the last essentially 4 years and throwing shade. So that's how it came about.
How did you feel about the experience? I've actually been the subject of a documentary myself. There are times when it's great. And there are times when you regret your decision to say yes. Like, there are times when you're like, I really do not want to have this camera following me around right now. I don't want someone asking me about, you know, what I'm thinking and feeling. But then, at least in my case, like I was very proud of the result. You know, it felt like all of the energy and dedication and work paid off. What was your experience?
Yeah, I had some of that same experience where, you know, while you're in it, there were times when it was difficult to say, why am I doing this? You know, and I didn't have editorial control over the film. You know, it was, I tell people, it's not my film. I'm just in it. But I did have some influence on what photographs were going to be used. Once they showed me a rough cut and I was like, well, that's great, but why don't you consider these pictures for that section? And so that sort of helped me, you know, I think, feel good about the film as an entity, as a whole. And I thought they did a great job. Despite its main subject, I think it's a great film, is the way I would when I agreed to do it, one of the things I said is, you've got to promise me you're going to do everything you possibly can to get this film released before the election. You know, yes. And they gave me, you know, you can't ever say for sure, but they gave me their word that they would try. And they did. And, you know, we had some huge complications because of COVID. They kind of had to finish a lot of the production and make choices based because of COVID, where not everybody was in the room. I mean, they were, you know, doing editing from, you know, all over the country. Where, you know, individual producers and the director and the editor were all in different places. So that made it really challenging. And I mean, the final interviews they did with me, we did over Zoom like this. And then they sent me like an HD camera that I hooked up myself so that while they were interviewing me, it would be on this, you know, HD quality film. So there were like kind of things like that they had to do. There are a couple of the interviews that they had scheduled that they had to scrap. But for the most part, we were able to, they were able to put it together, you know, despite COVID challenges.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/RS10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/RS10 today.
So again, you may be the most famous photojournalist in the world for good reason. I mean, you're incredibly skilled and talented. There's something ineffable about what talented photographers can do. It's wild. I actually have no understanding of how someone like you does what you do versus someone else who's also talented, but there's actually something of a difference. And this is a long-winded way of not just singing your praises, but also trying to identify the process that made you you and whether that's actually still going to be possible for future photojournalists. Because we're in an era now where you have someone like me, I've got like a device, and I'm just taking I'm sure terrible pictures. I've been a terrible photographer like my entire life, really. But I feel like now with technology, I'm the norm. Like, I think that there are a lot of terrible photographers because the pictures are so ephemeral seeming. It's like I can take 10 at the same time. So who really cares if I've done something specific or captured something magical? If I, as I'm surmising, the future of photojournalism is not exactly robust, like, what can or should we do to change that or help support it?
I mean, the good thing about today, where we are, is that any person that wants to be a photojournalist can have a forum to present their work because of the internet. They can do it on Instagram. They can do it on a website. They can post their own pictures, and they can almost be like their own, photo newspaper, if you will. The bad thing about it is how do they sustain that financially, right? It's nobody's paying you necessarily to do that. And as you say, newspapers have cut back positions. I live in Madison, Wisconsin now. They only have 4 staff photographers where, it's probably, I think back in the day, they probably had 12 or 15. The large newspapers have cut staff.
2,000 newspapers themselves have gone out of business. So, you talked about how the Chicago Tribune at one time was getting bought by some hedge fund back in 07 or 08 or whatever it was. At this point, the newspaper industry has gotten rolled up and consolidated into a handful of operators that are themselves owned by private equity firms who are now ringing them for cash. So they're not growth operations. I just want to let people know 2,000 papers have disappeared that we know of, and that number is going up all the time.
No, and I think it's, that fact is playing out during COVID in the sense that if you remember after 9/11, it happened in one town, well, 2 towns, D.C., but primarily one town. The New York Times, the hometown newspaper, did these amazing portraits of people who had died, the more than 2,000 people that had died. You really connected with them as people who had lost their life because of this national tragedy. Well, we've now had the equivalent of 73 9/11s or something like that. And local newspapers are not doing those kinds of stories because they don't have the kind of bandwidth that they should have and profiling people in their community that have died because of COVID. It's affecting us that we think of these people who have died and we don't really know them. Unless you personally know somebody that died, there's not the kind of connection to this tragedy that we all had with 9/11 because of what the New York Times was doing with these portraits.
The loss of local journalism and photojournalism specifically has a real profound impact. And I certainly would not have drawn the comparison you just made, but it's very, very powerful and apt. You think about all the people that have lost their lives that the New York Times did that headline where it just had their names, and that was very dramatic. As we all know, a photograph is much, much more powerful than a name.
Yeah. And we don't see many of the local newspapers getting inside, hospitals and showing the trauma that's going on and continues to go on for months for whatever reason. I mean, early on, we saw that in the New York Times, the Washington Post, some other big newspapers, but we're not seeing that by and large in daily newspapers across the country. So people are, listening to the person who shall not be named telling us how it's all a hoax and, we're right around the corner. And, part of it is that the local newspapers and local TV stations are not covering this stuff on their local level. One of the things you talked about photojournalism specifically, even when I was teaching back in 2007 or 2008, I was telling the students that the staff jobs are going away and you've got to rethink, you know, if you really want to do photojournalism, how are you going to stay afloat? And, you know, because most people end up being freelancers. And so you need to know how to run a business. And you also need to understand that in order to make it financially, you've got to branch out and not think just about doing photojournalism, but you've got to survive by doing other kinds of photography to supplement your income, whether that's shooting weddings or portraits or a little commercial work or something. Doesn't mean that you give up doing photojournalism, but to stay afloat, you've just got to branch out a little bit. And, you know, another, this is sort of like a little off topic, but, you know, you talk about yourself with your iPhone or whatever kind of smartphone you have making pictures. And, you know, I would argue that a professional photographer who is good at their craft will do a better job than you. However, citizen journalism is important it's been important, especially the last five years in documenting things that are going on. I mean, think about this. The whole Black Lives Matter movement just got ratcheted up so much because of a 17-year-old high school girl who had the presence of mind to film the whole George Floyd incident. And it wasn't like one of those videos that you see where it's like you can't quite tell what's going on. This girl held her shit together the entire time, not knowing that he was going to die, but just stayed with it for 7 minutes. You know, and, you know, I will actually reach out to the Biden people at some point and say she deserves the Presidential Medal of Freedom. She really does. And that's just some kid, high school kid with a phone that had a major impact on this year.
Oh, major impact, hopefully on U.S. history, really. I mean, if reform does occur, even if it doesn't, I guess that would tell another story, but it would still be historic. It's true. It's one of the things that I've always known is that these things are happening. It's just now we can see them. And we can see them because of smartphones and these new technologies. So they're definitely massive value adds and virtues. But you were casting photojournalism as like, look, you need to be able to pay the bills. And so, as you know, I ran on universal basic income. So I guess you can imagine a world where everyone just had more money flowing into their hands, that more people could become photojournalists vocationally or, you know, as a way to express themselves and share pictures with the world. There's a photojournalist named Chris Arnaud who left his Wall Street job and then became a photographer of working class Americans. I don't know if you've seen his work, but he was doing it purely as a passion. And then now it has taken on a life of its own because he's very talented and he's been documenting in many ways like the wreckage of American society. But it makes me think of that. Like if you were to free people from the confines of needing to make money to pay their bills in any given month, I'm sure a lot more people would want to pursue photojournalism and documenting the lives of the people around them.
Yeah, no, I think that's true.
So on your side, are you optimistic or pessimistic about both the field that you're possibly like the walking embodiment of it at this point, of photojournalism and the country writ large, given that I feel like you've seen more than just about any of us in terms of both the best and the worst of this country?
Yeah, no, I am optimistic. I sort of implore the photojournalists of today, given the propensity of the current president, the outgoing president, to label the press the enemy of the people and you know, this whole fake news stuff, you know, which has been really dangerous, and it's going to be hard to shake that. And I think that how that affects photojournalists is they've got to be absolutely ethical and honest and not, you know, not do anything to call in the call into question the authenticity of their photographs.
This is one thing that's going to be particularly important in an era of deep fakes where you can just doctor everything. One thing that an expert pushed me towards, which I thought was really fascinating, was that you can create watermarks on individuals' cameras. So in your case, you take photos, and if it says Pete Sews, all of a sudden it becomes like, you know, part of history. I'm sure that there are all sorts of fake Pete Sews's out there, like trying to pawn off their work. So this expert suggested that one of the things that we need in order to establish truth is that there actually is a way to tie every photo to the photojournalist through their device. You essentially have a watermark on the camera and said, this really was Pete Sews's work and it's unaltered. And that in some ways, photojournalists could become like the last safeguard on whether what we're seeing is real or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's people smarter than me that are working on this. And I think it's important, but it's also important to know, you know, you need to know your source. Like if you're on Twitter or Instagram or whatever. I was really offended the other day when I posted something on a new picture. It was at a protest here at the state capitol. And there was an argument going on between some Trump people and some Biden people. And one of my followers, you know, just their comment was, this is obviously Photoshopped. You know, and that connotation, Photoshop means, you know, it was fabricated and stuff. Yeah. And I like really went after this person because if you know me, anybody that knows me,
that is a real affront to your integrity.
I would never, you know, mess with a photo like that. And so that really pissed me off. And I appreciate most of my followers because they all come to my defense. You know, they know me and they know what they're looking at is authentic and real and not altered in any way. But you know, it not every picture from every photographer has that same degree of authenticity. And that, I mean, what you're talking about, I think could be an important way to you know, verify that what you're looking at is for real.
Yeah. Not everyone's Pete Sousa, but if everyone had like this stamp where it's essentially like I and the device stand by this and it's unaltered and the rest of it could be incredibly important. The fact that anyone would accuse you of that just seems patently ridiculous to me. And it's a sign of the time. It's back to that mistrust that we were talking about a little bit earlier. So if people want to see the way I see it, this important documentary with you as the subject, what's the best way that they can see it from their own home or I guess possibly in the theater, though it's probably more likely to be streamed?
I don't know what theaters it's in right now, but you can see it from home. And Peacock, which is the new NBC streaming service, it's free on Peacock. And you can sign up for Peacock for free. So if you want to watch it for free, that's the way to do it. It's also on demand at, you know, the usual platforms like iTunes, Prime, and a whole bunch of others.
Well, it's certainly money well spent. We are very hungry for excellent content and uplifting content nowadays, Pete. And I dare say that you're responsible for more uplifting content than maybe anyone else walking the planet. So congratulations to you and your team for telling your story. It's really incredible. They don't make them like you anymore. And hopefully we can make it so that there will be other Pete Sousas. Maybe, who knows? Maybe this lucky soul that ends up being the Biden photographer will end up carving out a legacy similar to yours, which I dare say would be like the highest aim that they could aspire to. So really, thank you for helping us all experience history at a higher level. Thank you for giving us like a window into a White House that was like the defining White House for so many of us. And on a personal level, thank you for taking such exceptional photos of me when I was in the White House that it made me feel better about myself and my presence in the world for years, well before that, because there was never going to be like an Andrew Yang presidential run. You know, like I can prove to anyone that I had no intention of running for president simply by the fact that my organization had no operations in either Iowa or New Hampshire. It had operations like a lot of other places. So as like an ordinary civilian, getting that portrait that you did of me, like it was really empowering and energizing. It was wild. There was the one with me and Obama, yes, but then there was like a simple headshot you took of me, ended up being the jacket photo on my first book, actually. You've touched so many lives in so many ways, mostly from people that have experienced your work. You know, just seeing a photo, they might not even know you took it. Just like the you know, like major photo of Obama that everyone recognizes. You know, you've touched at this point like hundreds of millions of lives. So thank you personally, and thank you on behalf of the world for helping us understand our world and humanity a bit better.
Well, thanks, Andrew. I appreciate it. And I appreciate what you're doing. Matter of fact, on my street, you have a couple of members of the Yang Gang, and they still have their bumper stickers on their cars. So,
well, please say hey to them for me. Say that Andrew Yang appreciates the heck out of them. And check out The Way I See It, this incredible documentary about Pete and his work of the last number of years. It really does elevate your understanding of both the kind of work that a photojournalist does, but also a bit more about what's going on in our country today. Congratulations to you and the team for making it.
Thanks, I appreciate it, and thanks for having me on.